This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we speak with Andrew Coburn about his recent article on prosecutorial criminal justice reform.
There are a lot of progressive people running for prosecutors across the country, and Andrew Coburn thinks it's going to have a profound effect.
CIA expert Douglas Valentine joins us to talk about his recent book, The CIA as Organized Crime.
The subtitle of his book is How Illegal Operations Corrupt America and the World. You read his book, and you'll see it sure does.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
Can progressive prosecutors achieve meaningful criminal justice reform? Returning guest reporter Andrew Coburn addresses this question in his recent article in Harper's Magazine called Power of Attorney. Attorney Dave Clegg, running for the office of prosecutor in Ulster County, New York, has written that prosecutors are the most powerful elected officials people probably know the least about. They are the gatekeepers to the criminal justice system. People don't realize how the DA's decisions impact people facing the criminal justice system and the long-term consequences suffered by their families and their communities. A DA serves with broad discretion and little oversight. For decades, harsh decisions by tough-on-crime DAs have made the USA the world leader in over-incarceration. Most district attorney races go unchallenged, and DAs can remain entrenched in power for decades. DAs have been active roadblocks to justice reform efforts and transparency and change. Hopeful prosecutors with good ideas have been running in cities across the country. What reforms are they advocating? What kind of resistance are they coming up against? We speak with Andrew Coburn, the Washington editor of Harper's Magazine, about the appearance of progressives running for prosecutors in cities as diverse as San Francisco, California, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, Baltimore, Maryland, and Queens, New York, and Ulster County, New York. Andrew Coburn, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Great to be with you.
In your current Harper's Magazine article, Power of Attorney, you wrote that, quote, strange things are happening in the world of American criminal justice. What is happening and where?
Well, it's really happening all over the country, particularly, let me qualify that, particularly in the big cities, but not just in the big cities. And what is happening is that there's a whole movement to reform. There's a general demand for reform, I think spurred most basically by the uncomfortable fact that the United States, by a huge margin, imprisons, incarcerates many more people than any other country in the world, certainly by head of population. I think proportionately, the next in line is El Salvador, and after that, I think Turkey. But we are the unquestioned leader. So that isn't of itself considered, quite rightly, a national scandal. And secondly, so that has spurred a movement for reform. But what is interesting to me, and what is really the focus of my article, is that this reform effort, the focus of this reform effort has been particularly on prosecutors and a realization of that the prosecutors, the district attorneys, state and local, who are responsible for, the overwhelming sort of proportion of criminal justice administration in this country, they are the sort of focal point of the whole system, and that's what's being addressed.
Now, what programmatic changes specifically are progressive prosecutors putting forward in their election campaigns?
They're going for the decriminalization. This is, a broad generalization and overview. The decriminalization of a lot of low-level offenses, most obviously and most, generally marijuana, low-level drug offenses in the states where marijuana is still illegal. Lots of prosecutors in their campaigns, progressive prosecutory campaigns, will pledge not to prosecute low-level marijuana consumers, people caught with a, you know, small amounts of personal consumption, sex work, also another very pervasive key issue is cash bail. And this is very important. In a lot of places, you know, when someone is called in for arrested and is awaiting trial for some low-level offense, there'll be a bail set. They have to come up with a certain amount of cash to post bond, or at least a proportion of that to pay the bail bondsman. If they can't do that, they can't come up with that money, they stay in jail. So basically people are being incarcerated for being poor. And so a lot of process, it's a big focus of progressive campaign platforms, is to abolish cash bail, to say we will no longer, you know, keep people locked up just because they can't come up with what to many of us would be quite a small amount of money, but to, you know, people of diminished income, reduced income is, you know, is an unmanageable amount of money, and therefore are locked up even though they haven't been found guilty of anything.
And what about people who are drug addicted or people who have mental problems? And aren't these prosecutors saying that jail is not the right place for these people? They should be diverted into a different kind of social program.
I'm glad you mentioned that. That's again a common theme, and that's not just, interestingly, that's not just in prosecutor races. There's been a very interesting and significant initiative in Los Angeles recently this year, where they were about to spend, forgive me if I can't remember the exact sum, but $1 billion plus on a very big new jail for women in downtown in Los Angeles, and there was a grassroots movement to stop that and to instead to put the money into a mental health treatment center, which is what is happening, I believe. So that is, you know, that you're absolutely right. It's absolutely key, because so many people who are, you know, who get involved in the criminal justice system, it's really thanks to mental illness, mental problems, or, you know, problems of addiction, medical issues, really, rather than innate criminality.
We spoke recently with attorney Chase Aboudin, who's running as a prosecutor in San Francisco, and he was in the public defender's office, and he said about 80% of his clients were either drug addicted or had mental problems and certainly did not belong in the criminal justice system. But I wanted to ask you about this, Andrew Coburn. You write about the young chief prosecutor attorney Stephanie Morales of Portsmouth, Virginia, which has a population of 100,000 people. She's an African-American woman in a town of mainly African-American working-class people. She wants to be viewed as a, quote, public servant rather than a detached, impersonal instrument of law enforcement. You write that she has a holistic vision of her job. What does this mean?
Well, it really means, I mean, what Ms. Morales feels is that, you know, traditionally in that office, as in most DA's offices around the country, and I mean, Commonwealth attorney is what they call DA's in Virginia, you know, basically, you know, as I say, as you said in your question, the just an instrument in the conveyor belt from, you know, arrest to prison, or conviction at least, and punishment of some kind. And the prosecutor's job is simply to, you know, lubricate that process, to try the case, to get the defendant, get a guilty plea or a conviction and send them on their way. And what Morales' view, and she's not unique in this, is that really she should see, you know, that the her job is to serve the community, you know, to consider all aspects of a situation, or, you know, in this case, a criminal justice situation, like when someone commits a crime, why did they do it? How can they be treated? What's the best way of preventing them from doing it again? What's the best thing can be done for the victim of the crime when pursuing a case against a defendant, and perhaps starts thinking about jail, thinking about the impact on the defendants and possible the persons being incarcerated, on their family, what will be the effect on their children? Because it's something I found an astonishing fact that half the families in this country have a near relative who has been incarcerated at some time. And that has a very, you know, very pervasive effect. It can really cripple families and cripple children, you know, down the line. So Stephanie, that's why I use the word holistic. She takes a, you know, look at the entire spectrum of a case. I mean, both the victim, the perpetrator, you know, what's to be done about it, what is the impact on all parties, not just the victim, but on the family, as I said, of the defendant. So that's really what she's talking about.
Currently, there are about 27,000 mostly elected prosecutors in the United States. Los Angeles alone has 1,000 prosecutors and a $400 million budget. Andrew, why do you think prosecutors, in your words, have, quote, an untrammeled power?
Well, two main things I'd cite. One of them is historical. I mean, that's, you know, since the beginning of this country, the whole idea of the elected prosecutor, you know, the prosecutor is the person who decides, you know, pushes the case, who does their best to get a defendant sent to jail or at least convicted. I mean, that's their job. As I've just been saying, that is changing a bit with examples like Stephanie Morales. But secondly, there's a development that happened in recent decades, which has really increased their power, which is because of the volume of cases. What happened is that we really have fewer and fewer actual criminal trials in this country. It's really gone down very markedly in the last 30 years. So what's happening is that instead of, you know, the prosecutor brings a case and it goes into court and the defendant hopefully has a defense lawyer and it's argued out and the jury and the judge, you know, the jury decides guilty or not guilty, which is, you know, most people's image of the criminal justice system. But in fact, in I think 95% of cases, that doesn't happen at all. It's the prosecutor goes to the defendant and says, well, we can charge you with, you know, say it's a drug case, with, you know, possession with intent to distribute, i.e. drug trafficking, and we can send you away for 15 years, or I can charge you with simple possession and you'll get off with a short sentence or maybe even a fine. So, you know, that's tremendous power to decide. Really, they are judge and jury, because faced with that, a defendant, even if they're innocent, you know, thinking, you know, goodness, if I fight this and insist on pleading not guilty, the prosecutor, especially if they're poor, the defendant is poor, you know, doesn't have the resources to fight, you know, to challenge the case as brought by the prosecutor and the police. So the likelihood is that the jury will find them guilty and then they face the very stiff sentence. So if offered a deal to get off with a light sentence, you know, people tend to take it. By me and untrammeled power, I was really thinking of the power which we think, you know, our images of, that really belongs to a jury and the courts, you know, the trial system, but that actually has now been really taken over by the prosecutors.
Do you think that the push toward reform is the result of all the high-profile recent cases of police misconduct, including murder?
I think that has a lot to do with it. You know, the murder of Michael Brown, or the, you know, the killing of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, in 2014, really sort of heightened the issue and what was seen as prosecutorial misconduct. You know, the prosecutor was very loath to charge the relevant police officer, and, you know, the grand jury brought the indictment, but grand juries tend to be guided by the prosecutor. And other cases, most very spectacularly, a case in Chicago where, remember, Lacan McDonald was murdered by a policeman. He was, you know, he was shot for no reason at all, and then lying wounded on the ground, was executed by a policeman. And it took, you know, the misconduct, there was a cover-up, and it took a year for the crucial evidence, which was a videotape, to be released. It had been suppressed by the then state's attorney in Chicago. So that certainly fueled it. So I think, yes, that has really accelerated the concern. But there's another factor as well, which is the whole rise of sort of grassroots energy and activism in this country, particularly in the cities, which, you know, has taken other forms as well, like, you know, the election of, you know, most prominently of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez in New York. But there have been other, you know, campaigns like it in Houston, for example. Been very progressive slates have been elected, and that has helped propel progressive prosecutors, you know, into election victories and get them in office.
What kind of reactions to this should we speak about? What have these recently elected progressive prosecutors encountered? What are they up against?
Oh, they're up against a lot of entrenched interests, very very powerful ones, but most particularly the police. I mean, the Fraternal Order of Police, which is the umbrella for police union, which is both active policemen and retired police. I mean, they have been, I mean, vehement, I would say almost vicious in their attacks, particularly, well, an example I quote in the article is Larry Krasner, who is the district attorney in Philadelphia, who was a former defense lawyer with a very progressive agenda. And the police have actually gone to the Fraternal Order of Police have gone to the lengths of erecting billboards around the city saying, time for a change, enough is enough. You know, we need a new district attorney. They are so outraged by doing things like, for instance, looking into past cases where, you know, people may have been wrongly convicted. He's also said that he won't use police officers in cases as witnesses who have a proven record of lying. I mean, all this is, you know, absolutely throwing down the gauntlet. Another person who's faced in very strong resistance is Rachel Rollins, who's the district attorney in Suffolk County, Massachusetts, really means Boston, Greater Boston, and she has encountered, again, just horrific resistance. Ken Fox in Chicago, again, the police really, I think it's not too strong a word, they really hate her, and they've done their very best, mounted a very strong campaign to get her to step down, which she's resisted. But, you know, these people, a lot of them are interesting, are black women, are facing enormous resistance. But it's not just, you know, big, powerful sort of things like that. It's also when a progressive candidate, elected official, and in this case we're talking about prosecutors, gets elected, it's usually cuts across, or you know, it overturns a lot of traditional political arrangements in a city. And in, for instance, you mentioned earlier Stephanie Morales in this relatively small city of Portsmouth, Virginia. And Morales, you know, she ran against and she defeated basically a machine, you know, a candidate that was being blessed by the local, at least in her second election, when she'd shown an independent streak, and she ran against a candidate that had the blessing of the local Democratic political establishment, particularly a very powerful local elected Democratic official. So, you know, by virtue of having an independent progressive agenda, she aroused the opposition of, you know, traditional local power structures. And that can happen, you know, that's happened elsewhere as well.
Does the progressive agendas of these people, does that, you think, represent mainstream public opinion?
Well, you know, often their opponents will say, well, they're just extreme leftists, you know, like these women in Congress, you know, the squad. You know, this is this unrepresentative, extreme left agenda, which, you know, most people, mainstream opinion, rejects. But actually, turns out that, you know, most people in these relevant electorates think this is rather a good thing. Stephanie Morales, again, she was in the first time around, you know, she ran a special election because the previous prosecutor had resigned, and she won a victory, but, you know, people hadn't quite... She ran on a progressive agenda, but it wasn't quite so patent. The second time around, in 2017, she ran for re-election on her progressive record of prosecuting police and doing all sorts of things she'd pledged to do, and she got in with a thumping majority, a 26% majority. So it turns out that people actually, Kim Fox in Chicago, she had a hard-fought primary campaign, which she won with a good majority, and then when she ran in the general election, she got in with a 30% majority. So turns out that actually the voters, you know, not, you know, mainstream voters, rather approve of this agenda because it's so obviously sensible. You know, of course we shouldn't be locking up people who need mental health treatment. Of course we shouldn't be locking away people for years for tiny amounts of marijuana or, you know, or other sort of minor crimes. And actually, the proof of the pudding is that in places like Chicago and Boston and indeed in Portsmouth, Virginia, the crime rate has gone down. The number of people being sent to jail has gone down. Not just people being sent to jail, but the people, you know, the actual crime rate. So this is a very effective as a law enforcement agenda. It's not just letting criminals walk the street.
Is prosecutorial reform solely supported on the left?
No. I mean, it's interesting that it's not. I mean, Jacksonville, Florida has a you know, a very progressive, I mean, a prosecutor, Melissa Nelson, if my memory serves me right, who's a Republican, and she was a corporate lawyer. I mean, certainly no progressive, no leftist she, but she succeeded someone who had the, you know, had the label of being the cruelest prosecutor in America, who loved sending people to death row. But, you know, this Republican has, you know, there's nothing to quarrel with, you know, on this score with her agenda here. So I think you're going to see more and more of this. And let me give you one more example. In Queens, New York, this year, we had just a few months ago, we had a very, very hard-fought campaign for the post of Queens District Attorney. And you had a very, you know, left-wing, indeed, candidate, Tiffany Caban, who was a young public defender who'd never been a prosecutor. And she very, very nearly won, but her opponent, who was backed by the New York Democratic machine, you know, very entrenched establishment organization, also ran on a very had to run on a progressive agenda to, you know, to scrape out the very, very narrow victory that she had. She had to promise to, and she, I'm sure it was genuine on her part, to genuine feeling to, you know, to not prosecute low-level drug offenses, to, you know, to not to consider mental health issues, to not prosecute sex workers. You know, it's not just a sort of extreme outlier position where, you know, these people are getting in by tricks. It's a very widespread, widely based popular movement, in my opinion.
We're speaking with Andrew Coburn. Andrew, you wrote a really fine article, I recommend it to everybody, in this current October issue of Harper's Magazine called Power of Attorney. And in the article, you write that you think that there are profound implications, your words, profound implications, which will result in the current phenomenon of progressive prosecutors getting elected. How so?
Well, it's because I say, you're really referring back to what I was just talking about. You know, it's part of a generally progressive movement, particularly, again, in the cities. And, again, let me talk about the Queens election for DA, because what really frightened the establishment was that Caban wasn't just advocating, you know, criminal justice reform measures, which, as I, you know, which were, to a certain extent, echoed by her opponent. But she was also making some very sort of strong statements or pledges, which certainly frightened the real estate industry in New York about going after bad landlords. I mean, doing things that no prosecutors haven't would be a new thing for prosecutors in New York and other large cities, and really, you know, an overall very, well, almost sort of very radical agenda. And so I think, as you know, as the way, I mean, let me backtrack a little bit, the way that these reform prosecutors are getting elected is really thanks to it. You know, partly it's, you know, people, George Soros, you know, the billionaire, putting in money into their, directly into their campaigns, but it's also other people like not just small donors and other progressive people of wealth, like a foundation called Open Philanthropy, which is funds the grassroots organizations, like both local ones, like in Texas and Houston, there's a very important one called the Texas Organizing Project, or nationwide grassroots organizations like Color of Change, a very effective and effectively run organization. And, you know, so they, in mobilizing some grassroots support to support the election of a progressive prosecutor, they're also, that's a grassroots constituency, an organized constituency, which is going to be of, you know, considerable importance in other elections, you know, for, you know, school boards and, you know, mayors and, you know, city councils. So it's having political effects beyond just criminal justice. That's what I was talking about.
Andrew Coburn, we're coming to the end of our allotted time, but before we have to let you go, I wanted to ask you, what's the best way to follow news about criminal justice reform?
Well, yeah, there's an excellent online news service called the Daily Appeal, or The Appeal. You can Google it. It's theappeal.org. I can't remember the web address, but it's easy to Google, The Appeal. And that has a really an excellent roundup and sort of news stories of what's happening in this field and the whole field of criminal justice reform across the country, which I very much recommend for anyone who's interested. You know, they're very well-written stories, too, I must say. So that's my recommendation.
Well, if you think they're well-written, I'm sure they are. Yours are well-written, Andrew Coburn.
Thank you.
Before we say goodbye, how can people keep up with your work?
Well, I guess the easiest way, you know, my regular outlet is Harper's Magazine. So if you go to their website, harpers.org, and they do have a paywall, you get one free article a month per issue per month. But beyond that, it only costs like $20, $21 to subscribe. And I think everyone should subscribe because it's an excellent magazine, not just for my pieces. You can follow me on Twitter, Andrew M. Coburn, spelled Cockburn. And so I publish in other places too, but I always post them on Twitter. So you can look for me there. That's how to do it.
Well, great. I subscribe to Harper's Magazine. I bought a subscription for my son. It's a terrific magazine. Andrew, thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Oh, it's fun. Thank you.
You take it easy.
Bye-bye.
Bye now.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
In 1947, Congress passed the National Security Act, which led to formation of the National Security Council and, under its direction, the CIA. Its original mandate was to collect and analyze strategic information for use in war. Though shrouded in secrecy, many CIA activities, such as covert military and cybersecurity operations, have drawn considerable public scrutiny and criticism. In 1948, the Security Council approved a secret directive, NSC 10-2, authorizing the CIA to carry out an array of covert operations. This essentially allowed the CIA to become a paramilitary organization. Before he died, George F. Kennan, the diplomat and Cold War strategist who sponsored the directive, said that, quote, "In light of latter history, it was the greatest mistake I ever made." Since NSC 10-2 authorized violation of international law, it also established an official policy of lying to cover up the lawbreaking. We speak today with Douglas Valentine, author of The CIA as Organized Crime, How Illegal Operations Corrupt America and the World. Mr. Valentine's rare access to CIA officials has resulted in portions of his research materials being archived at the National Security Archive, Texas Tech University's Vietnam Center, and John Jay College. He has written three books on CIA operations, including The Phoenix Program, which documented the CIA's elaborate system of population surveillance, control, entrapment, imprisonment, torture, and assassination in Vietnam. His new book describes how many of these practices remain operational today. Doug Valentine, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much for having me as your guest.
Doug, how did you come to get such unparalleled access to top-level CIA agents, including Director Bill Colby?
Well, I'm not really sure of the answer. I was a nobody. You know, I hadn't gone to Columbia Journalism School. In fact, I was a college dropout. And I had written a book about my father and his experiences in World War II. And I wanted to write a book about the Vietnam War. And so I sent this book that I wrote about my father called The Hotel Talk Logan to Colby. And he read it. And based on him reading this book I wrote about my father, he agreed to do an interview with me about the CIA's Phoenix program. But I really just stumbled into it. And I think that the reasons that Colby talked to me and then introduced me to a lot of other CIA officers are complex. And I think a lot of it has to do with the psychology of the country at the time. That was in 1984, and what was known as the generation gap. But I'm not exactly sure why, but it did happen. And I think a lot of it had to do with the fact that I just had the audacity to approach Colby and ask him to help me write a book about the Phoenix program, which nobody else had done at that time.
Doug, the book that you wrote, The Phoenix Program, America's Use of Terror in Vietnam, is considered by many the definitive study of the CIA's secretive counterinsurgency program during the war in Vietnam. One CIA officer called it the greatest blackmail scheme ever invented. What do you mean by that?
Well, it meant that the Phoenix program was targeted against civilians. The civilians who managed the insurgency in South Vietnam. Not soldiers, not even guerrillas or terrorists, but these were civilians who were working undercover in political positions, generally speaking, to manage the insurgency in South Vietnam, and their names could be put on blacklists. And once their name was on, once somebody had informed about them and said that they were a member of this, what was called the Viet Cong infrastructure, the insurgency, then the CIA and its forces could go out and kidnap them, put them in interrogation centers, kill them along with their families, do anything they wanted to try and suppress them. And the problem was that lots of innocent civilians got their names put on these blacklists. In fact, one of the ways that the CIA and its forces in the South Vietnamese Special Police and its mercenary army, one of the ways that they got people to inform on the members of the Viet Cong insurgency was by threatening to put their names on blacklists. So therefore, it became a blackmail scheme that if you were just an average citizen and you did not support the government of South Vietnam, you could find your name on a blacklist and your whole family could be wiped out. So it became a way of not just attacking the members of this Viet Cong infrastructure, but a way of population control, a way of terrorizing everybody in South Vietnam and bringing them all into line following government policies. And the minute you stepped out of line, you could find your name on a blacklist.
A common theme is the CIA's ability to deceive and propagandize the American public through its impenetrable government-sanctioned shield of official secrecy and plausible deniability. Can you give us some examples of this, please, Doug?
Of plausible deniability?
Yes.
Well, first of all, one of the CIA officers that William Colby referred me to directly was a man named Tom Donahue. Tom Donahue was a veteran CIA officer. He had run the CIA's covert action branch in South Vietnam from 1964 to 1966. And then he later went on to join what was called the Vietnam Task Force. He was a very senior officer, and Colby arranged for me to have an interview with him. And in that interview, Donahue told me that the CIA never launched a covert action program unless it met two criteria. The first criteria was that it had to have some intelligence potential. It had to have some value to the CIA. And the second thing, it had to be deniable. the CIA does not launch any kind of program at all unless it's deniable. And it does this in a thousand different ways. I mean, you could, you know, I spent hours talking to Donahue about all the different ways that they do it. But the most common way of the CIA launching a covert action program that's deniable is by attributing it to another agency. They say the State Department is doing this, or they say the military is doing this, or they say a non-governmental organization like Amnesty International is doing this, or they say another country is doing it. They might say that the secret services of the government of Ukraine are conducting a particular operation, when actually it's the CIA that's conducting the operation and controlling the Ukraine security forces and paying their salaries and directing them where to go. So there's just a million different ways that the CIA does create plausible deniability for it, and of course at every step of the way they have the help of the American media, which is in a partnership with the CIA. The major newspapers and TV organizations never report about the CIA. And, you know, I mean, we're supposed to live in a democracy, and the media, especially investigative reporters, are supposed to be out there looking out for our interests and telling us what's really happening. But, of course, they don't do that. And what's really happening, the most important things that are happening and shaping our democracy, are the CIA's covert actions, which are all deniable and never reported on. So we hear, you know, mere civilians in the United States really never know what's going on.
Doug, in your book, The CIA as Organized Crime, you lay out some of the most egregious acts of the agency. What do you think are one or two of the worst?
Oh, you know, that's so hard to say, but certainly conducting paramilitary wars in foreign countries, for example, in Laos, the CIA organized an entire army of mountain tribes. They're sometimes called the Mios, and they're sometimes called the Hmong. Laos was supposed to be a country that was neutral, but the CIA organized an entire secret army of this tribe of Hmong natives. Most of the soldiers were children, young boys, 14, 15, 16 years old. And they sent thousands and thousands of these young boys to their death, in, you know, trying to stop the Viet Cong from coming down the Ho Chi Minh Trail through Laos. They just used this mountain tribe as expendable cannon fodder. And they do this sort of thing all over the world all the time. They've done it in Iraq. They've done it in Afghanistan. They do it in numerous countries throughout Africa, where they just organize militias and secret armies, and nobody ever reports. It's sent tens of thousands of these people to their deaths. There's never any price to pay for it. So for me, of all the many, many things they do, including torture and blackmail and even infiltrating various agencies of the U.S. government and using them for their own purposes, to conducting of secret wars and sacrificing young foreign citizens, that really strikes me as the worst thing.
How does the CIA dominate branches of the U.S. government, like the Drug Enforcement Agency and the State Department?
Under what's called national security laws and this, you know, a clause that was included in the National Security Directive of, I think it was December 1947, which gives the CIA the right to do, the president direct the CIA to do whatever is necessary in the interests of national security. Therefore, they can infiltrate any agency of the government and assign positions in that agency, for example, the Drug Enforcement Administration, to CIA officers, so that CIA officers can make sure that the foreign operations that the DEA is conducting, or the foreign operations that U.S. Customs or even the FBI, certainly the military, are conducting, are not infiltrated by foreign agents or, in case of the DEA, that actual drug traffickers that are working for the CIA aren't arrested. It's a way for the infiltrating the DEA allows the CIA to control the drug business around the world, which is really important for the United States and has been, you know, I mean, since before the CIA was created, when the United States was supporting the nationalist Chinese in China in the 1930s, the way the nationalist Chinese supported themselves was through opium revenues. And so the United States government allowed Chiang Kai-shek and his Kuomintang government to traffic in narcotics so they could support themselves. And the United States does that with various governments around the world, even to today, such as in Afghanistan, where the people who support the United States and its operations against the Taliban are often drug trafficking warlords, who again, in exchange for lucrative contracts, contracting contracts, the right to build airports or construction contracts, ante up young soldiers and in return, you know, who are sent to their death by the scores, by the hundreds, by the thousands. In exchange, these warlords are allowed to traffic narcotics. That's basically how the CIA does business around the world, and it's not just through the DEA. It's through every United States agency, U.S. agency that operates overseas. They all are subservient to the CIA, and they have to, the CIA has what's called cognizance over their operations and basically complete control of them.
We're speaking with Douglas Valentine, who wrote the book, The CIA as Organized Crime, How Illegal Operations Corrupt America and the World. Doug, what influence has the CIA's activities had on social and political movements abroad and in the United States?
Sure. This is one of the primary covert operations of the CIA. It's basically the essence of its mandate is to, through sabotage and propaganda, control political and social movements in foreign countries, and they do this in a variety of ways. It's been standard practice and sort of like the driving principle since after World War II. If I can just give a little background. After World War II, the communists had really been formed the underground forces of resistance against the Nazis in France and Italy and a couple of other European nations. And so immediately after World War II, communist parties became politically influential, and I'll just focus on France and Italy, and they all of a sudden were in control of the governments. And the CIA could not fight wars against France and Italy, so they developed a program called Courting the Compatible Left. In order to get France and Italy away from communism, they supported the Social Democrats, people who were hardcore communists, but people who were willing to work with capitalists, which of course is the driving, accept American aid and work with the Americans. And so this became a very subtle way of The CIA resorted to very subtle ways of luring hardcore communists away from communism into social democratic movements. And this began to bloom and blossom all across the world as a sort of a standard operating procedure. When it was necessary, when the communists were intractable, then the CIA would do such things as hire Corsican gangsters, which they did in Marseille and right after World War II, to break up communist strikes. And but generally speaking, they tried to do this through subtle forms of propaganda, blackmail, bribery, sabotage, you know, methods like that. There's a pretty good book about that by it's a war about how the CIA waged cultural war in the 1950s and 1960s, and the role that a lot of Americans played, people like Gloria Steinem, other intellectuals in the United States, who actually helped the CIA in this effort to lure people out of the Communist Party into social democratic movement.
Doug, let's talk about the class origins of the CIA. Who does it really represent in the United States of America? Is it the establishment?
Well, yeah, certainly. The CIA is not a social services organization, okay? Its mandate does not state that it should help poor people in the United States, okay? Its mandate is that it should protect the national security of the United States. And by definition, that means the people who actually own the industries and infrastructure, the banking system, the individuals who actually own the United States, the people who are millionaires and billionaires, the people who can be said to employ big corporations who employ thousands of Americans. That's what's meant by national security, is supporting those corporations and the people that actually, the Wall Street investment bankers, that faction of the United States. And when the OSS, which is the predecessor organization, the Office of Strategic Services, was formed in 1942 by President Roosevelt, the person he went to was a man named William Donovan, who'd been a World War I veteran and was a U.S. attorney in Buffalo and elsewhere. And Donovan actually went to all the elite people from the Ivy League colleges, from industry, and those individuals were all given the management positions in the OSS. And when the CIA was created, all those people from, the upper crust, the OSS was also often called oh-so-social. It was the foxtrot crowd from Georgetown. All those people went in and took over all the management positions in the CIA. This does not mean that the CIA does not hire people from all ethnicities, translators who speak unusual languages, in that somebody from Jacksonville, Florida, who plays football, or some guy from Texas, or who's a football player, can't get into the CIA and into its paramilitary division. What it means is that all the important decisions and all the management and the executive positions are filled by people from the upper class, and they know perfectly well that their job is to protect the interests of the major corporations and banking institutions and, like I said, the people who actually own America. That's what national security is.
And what is the CIA's relationship with Donald Trump? Is it independent from him?
Well, I don't exactly know. It's been theorized that when Trump was in trouble, financially in trouble, and that he needed an influx of capital, money, and he went to Deutsche Bank and massive loans were forthcoming to him, that the CIA may have had some hand in that the money that was coming to him from Russian oligarchs, who were basically mafia characters in the Soviet Union, had just collapsed, and the CIA wanted to, again, control political social movements in Russia, and of course it gravitated towards the wealthiest people, and it had tried to establish wealthy people in Russia who were beholden to it, the CIA and the United States government, that the CIA may have arranged for some of these Russian oligarchs to launder their money, their ill-gotten money, to Donald Trump through Deutsche Bank. Trump, being a greedy guy who never thinks beyond the minute, may have been unwitting, as to the source of where this money was coming from. Somebody might have said to him, Donald, why don't you go to Deutsche Bank? I think you can get a deal there. And just being a greedy guy who lives in the moment, he did it, and the money was forthcoming. And so he could have been an unwitting recipient of dirty money. That's a theory that's floating around. And if it's true, then No, the Mueller investigation and any no other kind of investigation that was ever launched in the United States would ever reveal it, because no investigation is ever allowed to reveal the CIA's hand. You know, so in a sense, Trump would be a protected person forever. If anybody read the Trump, the Mueller report, you'll see that the CIA is never mentioned. There's a reason for that. You know, these things come to us. People say that, you know, William Barr scripted it or somebody else scripted it, but you just never read about, you don't read about the CIA in the New York Times either. I mean, you just don't read about it. And it's because secrecy dominates our society. Secrecy dominates our culture. It dominates the world. And especially it dominates us through the secret of how we're dominated. And none of that is ever revealed. And if it was to be revealed, you know, and we were all to understand how the CIA operates and how it actually controls the information that we receive, then there would be, you know, a total disruption, upheaval in American society. So it just never happens.
We're coming to the end of our allotted time, Doug Valentine, but before we let you go, there's a story breaking now that Heidi and I have been discussing about Joe Biden and his son, Hunter Biden, and Trump trying to get Hunter Biden investigated for his position on an energy corporation in the Ukraine, and that's led to a call for impeachment and investigation. What's your take on this story as it's unfolding?
Well, I actually mentioned Hunter in a passage in my book, The CIA is Organized Crime. And, you know, he certainly, Hunter Biden was certainly not the only American to prosper as a result of 20 years of covert operations, CIA covert operations, to pull Ukraine away from the Russian orbit. And once that happened, hundreds of American business people, you know, just poured into Ukraine and assumed positions. Many corporations, not Loresco, I'm sorry, I wasn't prepared, I don't, you know, actually remember her full name, who've been in the United States government for 20 years, and the day that she obtained Ukraine citizenship, she became head of the Ukraine Treasury Department. I mean, and this is an American, you know, so if you start investigating Hunter Biden, then you got to investigate 100 or 1,000 other American business people and political figures who are what I call in my book super predators, who basically operate the way the mafia does. You know, they take over foreign governments by, you know, 20 years of CIA subversion, blackmailing people, setting them up, overloading them with loans from the IMF. Or something like that, and then as soon as they can't pay off their loans, they swoop in like vultures, and they take over their countries, and they take over their corporations. And so what Hunter Biden did, and what I stress in my book, is this is just business as usual. The only value it has is in this war of words that's being waged between the Republicans and the Democrats. And there's nothing that the CIA's involvement in setting up these kind of, you know, takeovers in foreign countries is never, ever going to be revealed. And we have this sort of, I think the word is stasis between the Republicans and the Democrats, where we're subject to the spectacle of the Republicans and Democrats smearing each other, the investigative reporters never getting to the root cause of all this, which is the fact that America is an imperial nation that is subverting and overtaking foreign governments on a daily basis around the world. And so we're subject to this spectacle, and that's all we ever see. And the powers that be are perfectly happy for us to be enthralled by this, what I call the anvil chorus, of just one side hammering the other with smear tactics ad infinitum. And in the meantime, nobody ever really knows what's going on, because everything that's really important is secret and covered up.
Doug, unfortunately, we have come to the end of our time. How can listeners read more about what you've done and your body of work on the CIA is really magnificent. Do you have a website?
Yes, I do. DouglasValentine.com, which lists all my books. Plus, if you go to Google, all the books just, you know, and you punch my name in, then I'm usually the first Douglas Valentine that comes up. And there's a, you know, Google has all my books listed. And at this point, there's like 8 or 9 of them. I can't remember anymore.
Thank you so much for being on with us today. And we hope to stay in touch as future political developments unravel.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org.